Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to the 9th series of Reading Our Times. In this series, we're navigating our way through a world of confusing and often contentious ideas, equipped only with big books, serious authors, and time to think. We're going to be talking about slavery and reparations, wokery and left-wing politics, poetry and our sense of the sacred. We're going to talk about the origins of the West, what's behind the assisted dying debate, about the way the Enlightenment has been co-opted into the culture wars, about how our evolutionary past continues to shape our political present, and in a live recording at the How the Light Gets In Festival in London, I'll be talking to critics and publishers about books and the future of civilization. And underneath it all, of course, lies the question to which Reading Our Times always gravitates. What does all this say about the human condition? Let me begin this week with a confession. I cannot help but feel very nervous when I read a book that claims to explain the modern world, or the modern mind, or the modern anything, with recourse to evolution. It's a popular genre, not least since sociobiology rose from the intellectual ashes of social Darwinism 50 years ago, and biologists and then psychologists have started to claim that because we have genes, we are genes. There is, to be frank, an awful lot of nonsense churned out in this genre, up to and including academic papers purporting to explain anything from women's use of makeup to the reason why newborn babies cry at night by what happened during the Pleistocene 500,000 years ago. The problem is that the other end of the spectrum, the view that humans are a blank slate and that everything is culture and nothing is nature, is hardly any more credible. Despite it being received wisdom in so many of the social sciences, the idea that millions of years of evolution sculpted our physical form but left our inner mental landscape completely untouched is bizarre in the extreme. So it was with trepidation that I was alerted to a new book by Harvey Whitehouse, Professor of Social Anthropology at the University of Oxford. Inheritance has a subtitle, The Evolutionary Origins of the Modern World, that plays right into my prejudices. But the book itself is an extremely balanced, carefully thought through and well-evidenced exploration for our evolutionary inheritance, avoiding the Scylla of overclaim that we are flesh robots controlled by our genes, and the Charybdis of relativist fantasy, which sees every reference to human nature as a covert power claim. It seemed to me to be an obvious choice for Reading Our Times. And those suspicions were confirmed when I was reading it, I realised the book combined two key elements of the podcast: an interest in the big debates and issues of our time, and a fascination with the ethical, philosophical, and ultimately anthropological grounds that lie beneath those issues. Unlike most of our interviews, however, this book encourages us to move in a different direction, not from big current affairs to underlying issues, but from our understanding of human nature to the world today. I spoke to Harvey from his study in Oxford. Harvey, welcome to Reading Our Times.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
You structure the book around three building blocks or biases, or perhaps another word might be ingredients of human nature, which derive from our evolutionary past. And they're going to be the backbone of our discussion. But before we delve into them, I think we need briefly to discuss why there is such resistance in so many of the social sciences to the idea that evolution informs who we are today, that we have an evolutionary inheritance at all. Is this just the fear of social Darwinism, or is there something else going on here?
I mean, I think it could be partly fear of social Darwinism. I think the deep fear there is that there is something inherently right-wing or conservative about acknowledging that we have a human nature and that there are distinctive features of our psychology that evolved. I think that's really unfortunate because I think it conflates, you know, a very dodgy kind of pseudoscience with what is a very good science in the form of evolutionary psychology and the various evolutionary behavioral sciences. I think that they are agnostic about political matters, or put it this way, I think that they are really interested in establishing what is without attempting to make any kind of pronouncements about what ought to be or what should be. My impression is that they tend to be pretty left-leaning and liberal as a bunch. There is actually some evidence on this, a bit of survey work that's done that suggests they're actually further left than most typical social psychologists. But in a way, that's kind of irrelevant because I don't think it should really come down to what the political leanings of the scientists in question really are.
Yeah. And just to be clear, the association that some people draw there runs along the lines of, well, if we have a human nature, we're stuck with it, we can't adapt it, so we've just got to live with it rather than seek any kind of amelioration politically and culturally, right? That's the kind of link that people make.
Yes, that too is very unfortunate because, of course, there's nothing deterministic about this. I think what we're talking about when we talk about our evolved psychology is a set of dispositions and susceptibilities and things like that, which obviously can be shaped and fine-tuned in all kinds of ways. They can be tamped down, they can be exaggerated. And many of those susceptibilities and dispositions, it sounds a bit of a mouthful, I call them biases in the book. Those biases would lead us in both leftish and rightish directions in different contexts. I don't think there's any particular force towards conservatism there.
This is a point really worth emphasizing. By highlighting and, in some instances, I guess, reintroducing evolutionary factors into talk of the modern mind, modern psyche, the modern world, you're absolutely not advocating any kind of determinism or kind of crude evolutionary psychology. You're not denying that ethical reflection and cultural practices and institutions have an important role. That's why you talk about biases and building blocks, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. I mean, I'm often conscious of my natural tendency to think a certain way about the world and then to have to self-correct, as it were, and realize, no, that intuition is a very widespread and widely experienced one, may even be a pan-human one, but it doesn't necessarily reflect the way I want to see the world explicitly and reflectively.
So let's look at these three building blocks, these three biases, and look at the first, which is conformism. Tell us what conformism is.
Well, conformism in my book, literally, is about the copying of causally opaque behavior. That's also a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? What I really mean by that is the copying of behavior that has no transparent end goal materially. When we see other people doing things that have no obvious material benefit at all, but want to copy it simply in order to affiliate, to be part of the group, that's what I call conformism. And it's a really widespread feature of human behavior. It's one of the most fundamental features of human behavior, really.
This is really important. It's conforming to imitate rather than conforming to achieve some end. It's not conformism as instrumentalizing, but conformism just to belong, right?
Exactly. I think that's crucially the thing about conformism.
We are an imitative animal. This is the root of this conformism. And you mentioned in the book that actually, according to some people, we're an over-imitative animal. Any idea why? How come we have gone down this path?
Well, I must admit, I'm not a great fan of this concept of over-imitation, even though, of course, I have to explain that in the book. It is one of the dominant paradigms in psychology to understand why we imitate in the way that we do, in a way that is very rare, actually, in other species. Because what over-imitation means, well, it comes from studies that psychologists have done, typically using puzzle boxes, where they show participants in experiments a way of opening a very complicated sequence of actions necessary to open a box, and they intersperse those actions with things that are evidently irrelevant to the task of opening the box. And the fascinating thing is that, for instance, developmental psychologists have shown that even very young children copy the completely unnecessary elements, even if the experimenter points out that they shouldn't copy the unnecessary or silly things that they do. They still do it. And I think this is where the term over-imitation comes from. But it kind of suggests that we're doing more imitating than we should, really. Mm. And in a sense, if you look at it from an instrumental point of view, of course, that's true. If you use puzzle boxes as your way to test this, then, of course, it looks like they're doing silly and unnecessary things when they copy the irrelevant actions. But I don't think that's the only way to look at it. In fact, my colleagues and I have done a lot of experiments showing that children copy more precisely, more fastidiously, more faithfully when actions have absolutely no end goal. So unlike the puzzle box paradigm where there is an end goal, there's nothing at all coming out of it. And yet children copy those things much more carefully than they copy things where there is a suggestion of an end goal. And I think that suggests that it's not just overdoing something instrumental. It's actually a different kind of copying altogether. It's the kind of copying that is about trying to be like other people and through that mechanism to affiliate with them.
Mm. Let me just push back on that slightly, because you talk about this early on in the book. And one of the points you made is that historically, one of the theories about this was that it was instrumental. Young children were copying because they believed that what they were copying was going to be instrumental to the ends they wanted to achieve. And it just so happened that a lot of the time it wasn't. But maybe they just don't know that these actions are irrelevant. And they don't know that they're unnecessary. And so to be on the safe side, I'll copy everything my parents do or my community does because I don't know what is useful or not useful in achieving the goals I want to achieve. So let's err on the side of safety here and copy everything. So in other words, maybe it is an instrumental copying. It's just that we don't know that some of it is unnecessary or irrelevant.
Yes, I mean, one line of thinking is that this is what's called a copy all, correct later strategy. So for the time being, I'll copy things that I don't understand in the hope that at some point I'll understand properly how this is done and realize which bits I can jettison and it won't harm the outcome. But that's not what we find in various experiments. There's different kinds of evidence that push us to think that this is really very much about affiliation, not about some kind of instrumental learning that is initially rather inefficient but becomes better over time. One piece of evidence, among others, is that children copy instrumentally pointless or what I call causally opaque behaviors more when there's some kind of anxiety about being left out. It's as if they do it as a kind of re-inclusion behavior, which supports this view that it's about affiliation.
Mm, very interesting. And this is all very closely tied with the concept of ritual, isn't it? Your previous book was called The Ritual Animal. Tell us how this links to ritual, which is so central to your thinking.
Well, when you think about ritual behaviors, at the core of all of them is at least some degree of causal opacity. There are elements there that have to be followed simply because it's the done thing, the proper way, it's the convention. And for no other reason than that, you need to go along with it. And you want to go along with it because presumably you want to be part of the group that does these funny behaviors or dresses in these peculiar ways or does other causally opaque things. It gets a little bit complicated because these instrumental and ritual stances are both possible to entertain in rapid succession. And, you know, some actions have ritualistic elements built into them. Some have more instrumental kinds of things built into them. And often behaviors are really a mixture of both of those things. I mean, when you think about dining etiquette, for example, I mean, we sit at the table, there is a very instrumental aspect to that. We are shoveling food into our mouths, after all, but we're also doing all kinds of causally opaque things to do with funny instruments and implements and passing things in certain directions.
High table at Oxford is a very strange place.
I know, we've got an almost OCD-like exaggerated form of ritual behavior there. But I think all eating behaviors and most aspects of everyday human life are punctuated by these ritualistic elements. But some kinds of behaviors are much more overwhelmingly ritualistic and some more overwhelmingly instrumental. Mm. And there is a weird hybrid, which I call quasi-instrumental rituals, which are all about magically changing the world. So there is a very salient end goal to bring something about, but you do it magically. And the idea is that nobody could unpick the causally rational sequence that leads from the action to the outcome. Mm. So in that sense, they remain causally opaque and therefore rituals.
Yep. Now, obviously, ritual has a profound connection to religiosity, which is the second of your three biases. You say early on in the book, religion is not merely an optional addition to the cultural repertoire, as many atheists assume. Rather, it is an inescapable byproduct of the way our brains evolved. And I do agree with that profoundly, I think. I will, in a minute, push back on one element of it. But I think, at first, you need to explain what you mean by religion here, because it's likely not to be quite what most listeners automatically associate with the word religion today.
That's right. I mean, I do talk about religiosity as a set of quite distinct evolved biases to think and behave a certain way, but which consist of things like mind-body dualism, the idea that there is some part of the person that can be separated from anything physical. And that's related, of course, to afterlife beliefs, the idea that even after the body has expired or been destroyed, there's something that continues. The idea of, I know, imminent justice, that what goes around comes around, that baddies will get their comeuppance. We just talked about quasi-instrumental rituals, the idea of magical processes in the world that we can manipulate, the way that we think anthropomorphically, attributing agency to all kinds of things around us. And imagine, for example, also that the great features of nature are that way because of some kind of intelligent design. All of these kinds of ideas have their roots in our evolved psychology. And I do think that they are always going to be present as long as there are humans of our species. The point is, though, that there is obviously another sense in which people use the word religion. And I try to grapple with this too in the book. And they use the word religion to refer to very highly elaborated cultural traditions with distinctive names and identities associated with them that may incorporate some, but not necessarily all of those elements I just listed, but a whole lot more as well, including elaborate theologies and philosophies and all kinds
and
of
an ethical orientation. That's a critical point, isn't it? That's what we so often associate with religion today. But the point you make in the book, that's a kind of a legacy of axial age revolution. You want to say a little bit about what happened in the axial age?
Well, I think of it more of a stage than an age. We built this huge historical database that looks at world history and quantifies it and looks at features like the rise of moralizing religions and tries to establish when they occur. And broadly speaking, they occur after the sharpest rises in social complexity globally. So we're talking about quite late appearance. There was a real flourishing of this stuff in the first millennium BCE, which is often associated with a sort of axial age, as you rightly put it, you know, a phase when our philosophies and religions were moving in a new direction towards more, let's say, more egalitarian in some ways. Philosophies, ideas that were more philosophically about the tamping down, really, of extreme forms of inequality.
I mentioned my pushback. If any of my committed secular humanist friends were listening in, they might say, in fact, a research project that was published a couple of weeks ago said, well, okay, but Britain is now entering its first atheist age. That was the headline from this research project. And an unprecedented number of people in Western Europe said they don't believe in God, they don't belong to any particular religion, that actually you can say that religiosity is baked into our evolutionary inheritance. But the evidence around us in 21st century Britain and Netherlands and France and Denmark and increasingly even places like the US, certainly Canada, shows that that isn't the case. What's your response to that?
Well, this is one of those situations where it's incredibly important to be clear what we mean when we talk about religion. If we're talking about those intuitive features of religiosity that I started listing, and I mean, the list goes on and on, but if we're just talking about those aspects, there's some very little evidence that those things are becoming less prominent as features of our natural ways of thinking and behaving. I mean, I think the things I listed will continue to be detectable in psychological experiments the world over indefinitely. There's no reason to think those things are in decline. In fact, I think what's tending to happen is that these intuitive features of religiosity are manifesting themselves in a variety of different ways, but they've done that throughout history. I mean, the ways in which they manifest themselves have changed. We may be less keen on things like spirit possession and witchcraft, but more keen on things like homeopathy and being convinced by the cosmetics industry to buy certain products. The manifestations change, but the central underlying psychology is much the same. So I don't think that's really changing.
Yeah. So what we're effectively saying here is that if religiosity is one of the building blocks of our nature, religiosity itself has various different building blocks as part of it, but that it seems in certain parts of the world, certainly not across the whole world, but in certain parts of the world, they are being used to build slightly different structures than yes. had been the case, say, 100 or even 1,000 years ago.
Yes, but I do think it's important to differentiate the religiosity that I'm talking about, the intuitive stuff, from the complex traditions that we think of when we talk about religion typically, which is the world religions primarily, and their offshoots. And there, these organized religions, some very interesting things are happening, and these are being tracked demographically around the world. And there is a process of secularization going on in some parts of Europe and some regions and populations in North America and different age groups. There's a lot of interesting stuff happening there. There's no denying that. And it is important to understand and follow those things, but also to differentiate that from any claims about a sort of decline in intuitive religiosity, yep. which I think is less well yep. founded.
And even taking that first point into consideration, it's worth pointing out that the Pew Forum predict that 21st century world would be more religious in that kind of world religion sense than we are at the moment. So we can't mistake secularization in Northwest Europe for what's going on in the whole world.
Exactly. There are some remarkable things going on in South America, in sub-Saharan Africa, in much of Asia, and in former communist countries. There's a lot going on there.
This is an unfair question to ask, and we could spend the rest of the time discussing it, but I'm interested to get your reflections on why we have these intuitive building blocks that make up our religiosity. I had Robin Dunbar on the show a few years ago. In fact, his book on how religion evolved is on my shelf behind me. And there are various different ideas, aren't there, about hyperactive agency detection. So we detect agency in absolutely everything that we have naturally, kind of an intuitive psychology, that simply the capacity to mind read, all these things evolved, and they are the reason why we have this intuitive religiosity. What's your sense of where the origins of that lie?
I think broadly speaking, the cognitive science of religion field itself generally described as the cognitive and evolutionary sciences of religion, because it really encompasses a lot of different perspectives, including evolutionary psychology. I think a very dominant idea is that a lot of these intuitive features of religiosity are byproducts of things that evolve for other reasons. So you mentioned agency detection. That has an obvious adaptive value, being very alert to the presence of potentially dangerous agents around us. In fact, one of my colleagues refers to this as hyperactive agency detection and suggests we have a specific device for doing that, and that it becomes very tripwired, if you like, in environments that are a bit scary. So it's not surprising that in dark or dangerous environments, our alertness increases to the presence of agency. And if we have the kind of psychology that imagines disembodied spirits and things like that being around, that's this environment where we'll really feel it very intensely. But that's a sort of byproduct argument, that it's not that it's necessarily adaptive to think that there are ghosts and other kinds of spirits around, but that it is quite a salient idea to have under certain circumstances, and that's why it spreads.
It's interesting that those views are often articulated by people who actually want to dismiss religion. In your book, I couldn't tell where you personally would sit on this particular issue. You're studiously non-judgmental. And I wanted to just push this a little bit further before we leave religion, because I had Daniel Dennett on the show a year or so ago, not long before he died, in fact. And famously, he advocated the hyperactive agency detection device in his book on religion. He's part of this movement that wants to explain religion away, as it were. But there's another approach that, slightly provocatively, I'll put to you. We evolved depth vision because the world does exist in three spatial dimensions. We evolved the ability to read one another's minds because we have minds. We evolved the ability to conceptualize mathematics because, you could argue, mathematics exists in a kind of quasi-Platonic sense. Perhaps we evolved our sense of religiosity as a response to a genuinely existing spiritual reality or dimension. In other words, it's not maladaptive, but it is actually truly adaptive. How would you respond to that?
Well, can I just preface my answer by saying that my understanding is that this concept of a hyperactive agency detection device No disrespect to Dan Dennett, but I think it was originated in the work of Justin Barrett, who is a very committed Christian. So there's no incompatibility between the byproduct explanation and Christian faith and or any kind of religious faith. So I just want to emphasize that these are not incompatible positions. Yes. I think on this question of whether we perhaps have an evolved religiosity because it's a response to something real out there. I guess I can see why you might think something like that, but I think that intuitive beliefs evolve because they're useful, not because they're true. I mean, there may be some overlap there. It would be a very bad thing if we were to go around bumping into trees and stuff. So obviously there needs to be some element of reality in there. But I think a lot of the things that evolve in our psychology do so because they're useful, but not necessarily a true reflection of the state of the world around us. Mm. So for example, it's very adaptive to have distorted ideas about our relative size and strength and formidability when it comes to competition over contested resources, say with some other individual or indeed from another species. You know, when we're being predated, it's a good idea to think we're big and strong. And there may be a tendency, for example, to defer to leaders who appear to have supernatural powers. And that might explain some of the source of our religiosity. And we have some very interesting evidence for very early developing intuitions along those lines in pre-verbal infants. But that doesn't necessarily mean, because those things are useful, that they're also a true reflection of the state of the world.
Mm. Yes, it's all down to this million-dollar question, how far is usefulness and truthfulness coterminous with one another?
Exactly.
We can park that one. I'm not sure we're going to solve it today. Let's look at the third of your building blocks, which is tribalism.
Mm.
This is different from conformism. It's important to emphasize. What do you mean by tribalism?
By tribalism, I mean loyalty to the group, love of your group, willingness to do things for your group. I think tribalism is a very broad concept. I use these kind of intuitive words or familiar words, but as with everything like this, you have to unpack it and pick it apart. And there are different kinds of group loyalty, different kinds of group cohesion. They operate with different intensities and on different scales. And I tried to pick apart some of those differences in the book.
Mm. And this is strongly connected, I mean, in one sense, all three things we're talking about are strongly connected to our evolved morality as well. And one of the points you make very clearly in this particular section is cooperative groups will outperform non-cooperative groups. And therefore, for example, reciprocity is one of the seven kind of ethical building blocks. What are the links between tribalism, so how we defend one another and protect one another, and our evolved moral sense?
Well, there are links here. So one of the seven principles of cooperation that are judged to be morally good everywhere, that because the point about these seven moral principles, as identified by my colleague Oliver Scott Curry, is that we, say Oliver and myself and one of my students, have demonstrated that these seven principles are found to be morally good in all human societies, at least in the very large and diverse sample of human societies that we've looked at. But one of those seven is loyalty. That's about tribalism, right? Loyalty to the group. Another is about caring for your kin. And actually, a kin psychology and love of family members is one of those foundations for certain aspects of tribalism that I go into in some depth in the book. So there are these links with the seven moral domains, for sure.
Yes. And as you say, you deal with that in quite a lot of detail, because one of the points you make is that one of the ways of cementing loyalty to your group is to almost make it an artificial family. And you do so by having certain rituals and in particular experiences, and particularly when it comes to men, some painful shared experiences that provide the same kind of bonding mechanism that automatically comes with your kin, yes?
That's right. I mean, very broadly and crudely speaking, I distinguish in the book two quite different kinds of tribalism. One is based on what social identity theorists call identification. It's about sharing a set of identity markers. Basically, that's sharing stuff that you've learned socially from other people. But there is another kind of group bonding, of another kind of tribalism, which in some ways is more powerful because it drives more extreme forms of pro-social action, more self-sacrificial behaviors, which is not about simply sharing things that other group members have. It's about sharing something that is intrinsic to your personal identity and your sense of self. And this is what really taps into psychological kinship. And although this distinction may not be obvious, let me just really kind of nail it and drive it home to say that when you're identifying with a group, because it's based on shared identity markers that have been learned and acquired from other people socially, it doesn't tap into your sense of personal self at all. In fact, it's very depersonalizing, and it's very easy when you think of those sorts of group identities to forget who you are personally, to forget I'm Nick or I'm Harvey. You're much more focused on I'm an Arsenal fan or I'm a Christian or I'm something else that is to do with my social identities. But with fusion, this is another kind of group alignment. With the kind where we tap into our personal identities, what happens is that those personal identities become fused with our group identities because our group identities are actually based on these personally very salient characteristics. And those characteristics can be shared experiences, as you say. They can also be shared biology, which is a very common one in families, that we feel we share the same ancestry, the same blood, or whatever the metaphor is for shared phenotypic or physical characteristics.
So to be clear, this pans out in you and I have our identities fused with a wider group, and we are then prepared, I will be prepared to risk my own safety, my own security, if you are attacked, or indeed if a shared symbol of our group is attacked, because the attack on you or the attack on that symbol is effectively an attack on me now, because my identity is fused with this group, right?
Absolutely. There's really good evidence that when people are fused with a group, and we can talk about how you measure that and how you know whether someone's fused or not, but when people are showing these clear signs of fusion with the group, they will be far more likely not only to endorse willingness to fight and die and do other self-sacrificial things for the group, but will actually do it, that we have evidence that these are the real behaviors of people who are fused with the group.
So we talked about six chapters of the book, which look at how these biases evolved and then how they transformed. The last third of the book is about looking into the future. Now, I have to say at this point, our entire conversation could be conceived as like a modern liberal's nightmare. Because what we've said is, well, conformism, that's built into our evolutionary heritage. Religiosity, that's built in. Tribalism is built in. And these three are anathema to somebody who values sovereign, independent, free, individualized autonomy as our ultimate true good. And they would presumably say, if they were part of the conversation, okay, this might have been the case in the Pleistocene or the Axial Age or whatever it is, but we've got to get rid of this stuff. We've got to stop being tribal and stop being religious and stop being conformist if we're going to live and flourish in our modern world. That's not the approach you take, is it? You said, this is us. We can't just get rid of this stuff. We have to understand it and then work with it to make our world safer and better.
Exactly. I mean, I think the whole idea of eliminating conformism, religiosity and tribalism is pie in the sky. It won't happen because this stuff will resurface because it's part of our natural way of thinking and behaving. So the real question is, how do we work intelligently with the grain of these biases to make them work for us rather than against us?
I mean, you could even make the case stronger, couldn't you? Because I wrote a history of science and religion last year, and there's a chapter in it about science and religion in the Soviet Union in the 20th century. And it's really interesting how the concept of the new man is central to that Soviet anthropology, because what they're doing is they've discovered true, deep laws of history. And in the light of those, humankind can literally be remade, and cosmonauts were seen as new men who had transcended our earthly existence. But what happened then was the attempt to recreate humans in just that kind of socioeconomic way ended up being a catastrophe. You could make the argument, couldn't you? The attempt to recreate humans in an attempt to ignore our evolutionary history is even more perilous. Going against the grain is genuinely dangerous.
I think it is genuinely dangerous. I mean, I have to confess that as a young student, as a PhD student, I was fascinated by Marxism. I thought that historical materialism did reveal deep laws in world history that we needed to understand, and that it did point to the direction we needed to head in terms of, if not eliminating, at least managing our tendencies towards exploitation and political domination. But it was through the experience of actually doing fieldwork 2 years deep in the rainforest in Papua New Guinea, where I became fascinated by the ins and outs and intricacies of human thinking and behavior and wanted to study it more scientifically in the years that followed, that I began to abandon this sort of Marxist vision and felt that, no, we really need to work with what we can realistically pick apart and understand about our evolved human nature.
And the critical point there, going back to an earlier part of our conversation, is that going with the grain is not a determinist path. These are building blocks and biases and ingredients. You know, humans are malleable, and society is certainly malleable, and ills can be ameliorated. Going with the grain is not to resign attempts to build a better future. Rather, it's to facilitate them.
Absolutely. I'm far more optimistic than almost anybody I ever meet on this topic, because I honestly think that right now what's happening is that a lot of our evolved psychology is being manipulated and exploited by bad actors and by forces that aren't necessarily malevolent, but have malevolent outcomes unintentionally. Whereas if we really think intelligently about it, we can master a lot of these things in a way that is consensual and bottom-up and democratic, in ways that favour ourselves collectively and are best for humanity.
Yeah. So let's take a couple of examples of that as we slowly come in to close. The last of the three biases we spoke about, tribalism, it's pretty much a platitude today to say that tribalism is pulling us apart. I mean, you and I are having this discussion probably 2 weeks out of the US election. If you want an example of how tribalism can tear a society apart, you have to go a long way to get a better one than that. You say, in a way that will, I'm sure, raise a few eyebrows, the antidote to these dysfunctions is not less tribalism, but more. Tell us what you mean.
Well, what I mean by that is that people tend to think of tribalism as a divisive force. And that's because one of the dominant ways in which we think about tribes is the pathway that I talked about as identification. And identification does bring with it pretty much automatically a feeling of competitiveness, rivalry, derogation towards outgroups. It's a sort of automatic consequence, really, of being committed to your own group, that you don't really want other groups to succeed. But fusion, because it's based on the psychological kinship, this fusion of personal and group self, is very different from that. I mean, most people can understand what it feels like to love your family. I think most people love their families. Most people are fused with their families. But that doesn't mean they hate other families or that they feel competitive or rivalrous towards them. And one of the things about fusion when it scales up is that it is an incredibly potent force for getting us to act on big cooperative collective action problems in a way that does not require an external threat or an enemy. And the highest level possible, and this is the hardest one for most people to imagine, is doing that on a global scale. I mean, actually uniting with all of humanity to address global problems. I think that's something we absolutely need to do and to prioritize. And there's a ton of evidence that this is psychologically possible if you emphasize the stuff that fuses us to humanity.
So I appreciate your optimism and your positivity there. My friends will tell me I'm quite good at bringing the other perspective, but let me do so by way of gentle challenge. I understand what you're saying about I can belong to my family without hating other families. But nonetheless, one could make the point that to belong to my group, part of that means, by definition, not belonging to other groups. In other words, other groups almost have to exist in order for my group to exist. I don't necessarily have to hate them, but they have to be other. For me to say us, for me to use the word our, by implication, there is a them and a there. There, if I can put it that way. And that means that even if that in-group, out-group hatred isn't necessary, boy, we're always living on the edge of it. There's always the potential to turn the them into an alien, threatening them.
Absolutely. I mean, the us-them thinking is always lurking in the background, but it's not an inevitable consequence of our most powerful forms of tribalism. And this is really important to understand. If we just go back to this fusion mechanism for a moment, this is a situation in which our personal identity and our group identity become fused together as a consequence of recognizing that other people in this group have shared something that is really personally self-defining for us. And that could be an experience of trauma. It could be something really dreadful. But that capacity to unify in that way is possible both within groups that are embattled or at war with other groups and across warring groups. In fact, just to give one example of this, in one of our recent studies, we sampled Muslims and Jews in America who aligned themselves with different sides on the Gaza conflict. And we presented them with a speech in which a British politician described how suffering on both sides of the conflict was equally intensely, horribly painful from an individual perspective and from the viewpoint of members of the families of those suffering. And just simply listening to that speech had a dramatic effect on people's attitudes towards the outgroup, a positive effect. That doesn't diminish their sense of alignment with their own existing groups. And of course, those people in the survey were members of many different groups, not necessarily ones that pertain to the conflict, this particular conflict in the Middle East. But on that conflict, without diminishing in any way those identities, they felt a stronger sense of trust and positive feelings towards members of the outgroup. And those are the foundations for building peaceful solutions. They're not foundations for eliminating your existing commitments politically, not at all. There's no suggestion here that we're trying to dismantle or eradicate people's existing tribal alignments. But instead, what we're looking for is a foundation on which to transcend those alignments when it comes to solving collective action problems that could make us all better off.
I do find this interesting from a theological point of view because of the emphasis in the early churches. There is neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free, but all are in Christ. And Christ is this suffering figure. I mean, that's extraordinarily similar to that point you're making there about a speech drawing out the suffering of both different parties in that particular conflict is the thing that brings people together and breaks down the divides. In the ancient world, the Greek-Jew divide was massive. The slave-free divide was massive. And Paul can say those divides don't exist because the identification is with, as he puts it, the suffering Christ.
Yes, the identification and the fusion, because it's shared suffering, which is the core idea at the heart of it. And this is another reason why I say let's work with the grain of religion, because religion provides us with a lot of tools to solve these kinds of problems if we draw on the right elements of the toolkit and apply them in the right way.
Yeah. Let's conclude by looking at religiosity in the future, because we've already talked a little bit in our discussion about how these intrinsic building blocks of religiosity, they don't go away, they're used in other ways. And you make very clear, it's very, very interesting in this particular chapter in the book, chapter 8, I think it is, that the intrinsic religious building blocks are being hijacked by contemporary forces, very often contemporary market forces, in a way that's actively doing us emotional and psychological harm.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I don't think most of it is at all intentional. Of course, there are bots that are deliberately trying to sow discord and increase polarization and things that are corrosive to cooperation in society. But I think a lot of that corrosion is a consequence of people simply pursuing commercial interests in perfectly legal ways, but without really understanding or caring very much about the consequences of that for the way we interact with one another and our trust in institutions and in our political systems and in the democratic process and so on and so forth. Mm. I think all of those things are being corroded, and not necessarily because of a deliberate attempt to do it. In the book, I do argue that it is possible to think of ways of turning those things around. I mean, a lot of the problems that we know about are tapping into our evolved psychology in ways that we don't really attempt to interfere or intervene on. And we could do it through regulation. We could do it through the development of new habits, frankly. I mean, a lot of our habits of behavior are being shaped by commercial interests in ways that serve them, but not us. But we could take control of those things.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you're right. The advertising industry, social media, news conglomerates are harnessing our natural religious intuitions in ever more creative ways. For example, by using such techniques as brand anthropomorphism and behavior modification. Many, many years ago, I used to work for several quantitative and qualitative research companies doing consumer research, and pretty much my first job. Did a lot of focus group research. And one of the things that was made patently clear to me then was that the age in which advertising was about responding to needs was decades dead by that stage. What it was about at this stage, and this was the 1990s, mind, was about stimulating wants. And even then, the techniques for stimulating those wants were quite sophisticated. And I think they've got a lot more sophisticated over the years. And that's an example of what you're talking about, isn't it? You understand the building blocks, the biases, the inclinations people have, and then you try and stimulate them further in an attempt to sell your stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I think there's been a really interesting shift in the way we think about economics. We tend to think in terms of material wants and needs being met in terms of the growth of economies and things like that. But before capitalism became the widespread system it is today, people saw economic life more in terms of creating relationships and obligations and stuff that's rooted in tradition and ritual. And now those things are kind of there, but they're peripheral. You know, like gift giving happens on special holidays, and spending lots of money on rites of passage happens at moments that punctuate life, but is not part of the day-to-day stuff. And I guess religion provides a panacea to that way of thinking, that it provides us with a way of thinking about habits and rituals and daily activities that are more meaningful in terms of relationships and less about material wants and needs. And so this is another area in which religion, assuming it is going to stay, and I think that is a safe assumption, is a really potentially important player in the way that we build our daily lives, our habits, and our deep orientation to the material world.
Yeah. That's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, people who are fond of these etymological explanations do often point out that economics derives from the Greek oikos, meaning managing the home effectively. And the point about that is that there are existing relationships within a home that you need to manage, as opposed to these kind of distant, contractual, non-committal relationships that economics abounds in today.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a really good point.
Let's come into land with my concluding question. I've got to do things a bit differently this time. The usual question I end Reading Our Times interviews with is, what does what we've been talking about tell us about the human condition, about human nature? But we've basically been talking about the human condition constantly for our entire discussion. So on this occasion, I'm going to go in a slightly different direction. And my parting question connects with the kind of work that Theos does. We try and make a positive case for faith in the public square, particularly in contemporary Britain. From your anthropological and your psychological reading of human nature, where do you think that lies? Where do you think the most positive, compelling case for faith in public life lies in a society like our own that may or may not be entering its quote-unquote first atheist age?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think there is potential actually for a new kind of moralizing religion, you know, a kind of moralizing religion that taps into our universal moral intuitions, you know, the seven moralities cooperation domains that we talked about earlier, and that applies those moral intuitions to problems that we can all agree globally are important. The obvious ones are things like the climate crisis and biodiversity loss and warfare. I mean, there's lots of things there that we could recognize globally are problems that we need to solve and that can be solved if we apply our shared moral intuitions in a way that is galvanized through some kind of new globalizing form of religion.
The book is called Inheritance, The Evolutionary Origins of the Modern World. Harvey Whitehouse, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was our last interview this series, but it's not the end, because next week we've got a special Bookends episode. In it, I'll be looking back at some of the topics we've been discussing, but also asking the bigger question about the role of ideas in our sometimes divided and often angry world. Do join me for that. You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Lizzie Harvey, and Chinny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And you can also find us on our website, theosthinktank.co.uk. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. It'll help other people find the podcast.